Yeah, he was always a rock star. He really was, that's the funny thing. He was a very shy boy, very shy, very insecure, I would say, you know, and came from a very strict public school upbringing, very kind of repressed in a sense. And so his reaction to that was to go completely the other way, to be completely outrageous and build a character around himself, which he inhabited. And it came to its climax when he actually changed his name as well and became Freddie Mercury instead of Bulsara.
Keep yourself alive, keep yourself alive. Take you all your time and money, honey, you survive.
God, Freddie is a completely self-made man. He had his vision, he had his dream, and he constructed everything about his life to make this dream happen. And we were part of this whole kind of journey.
Now I'm here.
This is Brian May.
Hi, and I'm Roger Taylor. We're from Queen.
And we're in the studio with Redbeard, of course.
Quick, what's the best-selling British band in history? No, not the Beatles. That would be too obvious. Rolling Stones? Pink Floyd? Not even close. The British band that tops them all at over 300 million sold worldwide, reigning musical monarchs, is Queen. Freddie Mercury, Brian May, Roger Taylor, and John Deacon forming the band in London in 1971, the first five Queen albums have been remastered and expanded into two-disc deluxe versions, loaded with alternate takes, live performances, B-sides of singles, and newly discovered unreleased early demos. Despite their enormous popularity, Queen were never taken seriously by rock critics, points out Stephen Thomas Erlewine on AllMusic.com. And while those records were never praised, they sold in enormous numbers, and traces of Queen music could be heard in several generations of hard rock and metal bands over the next two decades, from Metallica to Smashing Pumpkins, end quote. Undoubtedly, one of the hallmarks of Queen's sound and broad appeal across continents and decades has to be the many seemingly disparate musical styles that the four band members boldly incorporated. I asked Queen drummer, singer, songwriter Roger Taylor what they hoped to sound like.
I would say we wanted to do the harmonic things, but better, hopefully. Vocally, that yes, we're doing, but combine that with the wonderful, a brutal, heavy influence of what Led Zeppelin were doing. And that was at the time we started. Obviously, we changed as we went along. But I would say that more than anything else, we wanted to combine those two sort of genres.
Queen, songwriter, singer, guitarist Brian May.
It was a vision in our head, really. I think we would have described it at the time as very heavy underneath, but very melodic and very harmonic on top. And there wasn't really a model, you know. We had heroes. Obviously, Jimi Hendrix was a huge hero. And Zeppelin were sort of almost contemporary, but they were our heroes as well. You know, they managed to do some of what we wanted to do, but they didn't have this other side to them. We were very fond of Yes at the time, you know, who had an element. They had this very complex sort of harmonic element, which is an inspiration. But our heroes also went much further back into time. So there's people like George Formby and the big bands and the Temperance Seven, all sorts of strange, eclectic influences on us coalesced and became what we were. So I think we were like a sponge and we absorbed all this wonderful music that was around us. It was a very particular time in history. It couldn't really happen now, I don't think. But we grew up with all these sounds in our heads and we knew what we want. The lucky thing was that Freddie and Roger and I had a very similar vision in our heads. So when we came together, it was easy to know which decisions to make to try and make this happen.
I was told
you grow a little wiser, a little better every day. But if I cross a million rivers and I rode a million miles, then I'd still be where I started, bread and butter for a smile. Well, I sold a million mirrors in a shopping alleyway, but I never saw my face in any window any day. Now they say your folks are telling you to be a superstar. But I tell you, just be satisfied and stay right where you are.
Keep yourself alive. Keep yourself alive.
Ooh, take you all your time and money, and honey, you survive. A Belladonna case, and I had a million dinners brought to me on silver tray. Give me everything I need, feed my body and my soul. Then I'd grow a little bigger, maybe that could be my goal. I was told a million times of all the troubles in my way, how I had to keep on trying and get better every day. But if I crossed a million rivers and I rode a million miles, then I'd still be where I started, same as when I started.
Keep yourself alive.
Come on.
Never sounding better. That's the long-lost alternate take of Keep Yourself Alive, the original of which leads off Queen's 1973 debut. This thrilling chestnut is an example of the impressive rarities and bonus tracks now added to the Queen 40th Anniversary Deluxe remasters of their first five albums. To record that first album, the fledgling band had to grab studio time in fits and starts between David Bowie sessions at London's Trident Studio, where Queen drummer Roger Taylor joined Brian May for this interview.
Well, you're right. It was recorded mainly at night time when David Bowie wasn't... Because we were signed to this studio, that they were our managers. This was a very fashionable studio at the time.
The owners of the studio, in a sense, owned us. They were our managers. But they didn't want to spend any money. So basically, if someone was in here like David Bowie and he finished a session at 3 o'clock, we would get a phone call and they'd say, come in, boys, you know, we've got some downtime, come in and do some work.
So we would go, you know, 2 till 6 and in the morning. And
so that's how that album was made. So we, although we had great technology around us, we didn't really have much freedom to use it. It was really grabbing little bits of time. And we were regarded as sort of the new boys who didn't really know anything, and nobody really wanted to listen to the way we wanted to do things.
Because we were being pushed slightly in, you know, towards this as the fashionable kind of sound with the drums, etc. Too dry and for us.
They put tape all over his drums, and they put cushions everywhere and sound absorbing, and they made his drums go...
There's famous Trident drum sound, it was called. There was a boo that was over there. If you imagine this big room, which is just this tiny bit of, and they used to put the drums in there and have taped up, you know, and everything, so it was dead. And that was the fashionable sound, you know, that David Bowie had used it. And I think that album suffers for that, but it has a lot of good stuff on it, though.
Yesterday, my life was in ruin. Now today, I know what I'm doing. Got a feeling I should be doing alright.
From the remastered and expanded Queen debut, the song Doin' All Right has to be one of the most dynamic arrangements in rock music, an example of what AllMusic.com's Stephen Thomas Erlewine calls, and I quote, the majesty and menace in Queen's earlier work. And then there was Ferdinand Bulsara, the mercurial frontman, Freddie. Here's Brian May.
Yeah, he was always a rock star. He really was. That's the funny thing. He was a very shy boy, very shy, very insecure, I would say, you know, and came from a very strict public school upbringing, very kind of repressed in a sense. And so his reaction to that was to go completely the other way, to be completely outrageous and build a character around himself, which he inhabited. And it came to its climax when he actually changed his name as well and became Freddie Mercury instead of Bulsara. So he was, I regard Freddie as a completely self-made man. He had his vision, he had his dream, and he constructed everything about his life to make this dream happen. And we were part of this whole kind of journey.
Okay, darlings, this is a little, delicate little number called White Christmas. Tweed. So sad, her eyes smiling, dark eyes. So sad, her eyes as if. Such a breathless night is this. On my brow, the lightest kiss. I walked alone. And all around, the air is safe. My lady soon will stir this way. Sorrow known. The white queen walks, and the night. Mother of the willow queen, I call her name. Beneath the window have I stayed. I love the footsteps that she made. And when she came,
it ends
The stunning, majestic live performance of White Queen, a song originally on 1974's Queen II, is all the more impressive when you realize that this London Hammersmith Odeon show dates from December 1975. What great sound! It's a bonus track now on the remastered and expanded version of Queen II. Next, Brian May and Roger Taylor reveal which early album is a personal favorite and why. For this interview and many more, keep up with In the Studio on Facebook and visit inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Brian May and Roger Taylor, Queen Part 1.
Hi, this is Brian May from Queen, and welcome back to In the Studio.
I'm Roger Taylor of Queen, and welcome back to In the Studio.
And I'm Redbeard. Even though Queen's debut had received modest exposure in the U.S., Queen II, in early 1974, had gone relatively unnoticed in the States, but the band did manage a hit from their Top of the Pops TV performance of the very British Seven Seas of Rye. Bursting with songs from all four members, Queen released another album in late 1974 called Sheer Heart Attack. Here's Queen drummer Roger Taylor.
With the second album, Queen II, I think we sort of... We did everything that we could possibly think of doing, and to the point of where we almost overcomplicated things. And I think we were starting to refine it down by then. And actually, Sheer Heart Attack is one of my own personal favorites, the album. And I think as a whole album, it stands up as well as anything we've ever done, really. Maybe other albums sold more, but for me, that's one. It's a very sort of clear statement. We'd started, that was the one that first found a sort of unified and slightly stripped down direction.
She keeps a Moët Chandon in a pretty cabinet. Let them eat cakes, she says, just like Marie Antoinette. A building, a remedy for Khrushchev and Kennedy. At a time, an invitation you can't decline. Caviar and cigarettes, well versed in etiquette. Extraordinarily nice. She's a killer. Queen, gunpowder, gelatine, dynamite with a laser beam, guaranteed to blow your mind. Ooh, recommended at the price, insatiable and appetite. Wanna try? To avoid complications, she never kept the same address. In conversation, she spoke just like a baroness. Middleman from China went down to Geisha Minor. Then again, incidentally, she was in that way. Perfume came naturally from Paris. Naturally. Because she couldn't care less. Fastidious and precise. She's a killer. Queen, gunpowder, gelatine. Dynamite with a laser beam. Guaranteed to blow your mind. Momentarily out of action, temporarily out of class. You're absolutely right. She's out to get you. She's a killer. Queen, gunpowder, gelatine, dynamite with a laser beam. Guaranteed to blow your mind. Recommended at the price, insatiable and appetite. Wanna try?
The single Killer Queen was the breakthrough hit Queen needed from their third album, Sheer Heart Attack. By now, Brian May's soaring, inventive, sometimes orchestral guitar playing was starting to command respect, even in an era of guitar greats. Here's Brian May and Roger Taylor with me in the studio.
I'll be very honest with you, I never really thought of myself as a rock guitarist until about a year ago, and I suddenly thought, you know, and I discovered it when I thought it wasn't going to happen anymore, because I felt like I was falling to pieces, and I thought, well, I've never really admitted that I was a rock star up to this point. I thought I was just maybe a student or...
Or sort of a women's writer for women's magazines.
But... Yes, you know, or a hedgehog protectionist or something.
Or a great protagonist of Save the Ant.
That's right, you know, I thought I was this guy who was sort of trying to choose his career and he was, you know, playing his guitar for a while. And I suddenly thought, well, for the last few years I've actually been this person that other people think is a rock star, you know. So it was all a great sort of source of happiness to us. I think, you know, it wasn't like a job and it wasn't like, you know, we have to succeed. We always just assumed that we would succeed and we would, you know, people would eventually realise how wonderful we were, I think. But again, as Roger said, slightly tongue-in-cheek, because it's on different levels. On one level, you think you can conquer the world, and you're quite confident of it. And on the other level, you see everybody else is out there having records plays, and you haven't the slightest idea how to get into the business. So there's a very mixed emotions. On one level, we thought, yeah, of course it's going to be a hit. And on one level, I think it was just a joyful surprise.
Stone Cold Crazy from Queen's late 1974 Sheer Heart Attack album actually predated the punk rock and speed metal trends to come later. This was the first album cover in a series of Queen albums that pointedly carried the statement, "No synthesizers were used on this recording." Amusingly interpreted by rock critics even to this day as some serious musical manifesto in rebellion to technology, drummer Roger Taylor told me that it was actually a band inside joke and a compliment to the innovative guitarist that Queen had.
And the first album we ever made, Brian did a lot of stuff on guitar with featuring specific harmony guitars, which is a fairly new thing at the time. And a lot of the reviews in England, I can quote one, Chris Welch in the Melody Maker, a paper never known for its accuracy, in fact famous for its inaccuracy, I might add, said a great use of synthesizers here. And of course it was all guitar, and that which sort of got up our noses quite a lot. So we made a point, and the synthesizers at the time were monophonic. You couldn't play chords on them. We tried fiddling about with a big ARP in the studio once, and all we could get was something that you could make with your own body, you know, a noise that you could make better.
And a toilet roll.
Yeah, with your own body. And with, you know, more organic sort of overtones to it. So we were a bit put off by the early synthesizers and decided that we would actually say, from then on, I think we said it for the next four albums or so, that we had no synthesizers on those albums, and it became a bit of a little thing, you know.
Guitarist Brian May of Queen.
And there was a chemistry happening with the band. You know, we discovered that we did work off each other very well, and the band had sort of come to, I think, its first period of real maturity, having done we had done some touring, as you know, and we discovered that we fitted into it very well. The band had a life, you know, it had a life of its own, which was indisputable, and you hardly stopped to think what it was. You just knew it was there and that you were doing something which felt right.
Here I stand.
Now, don't ask me how Queen could pull off Freddie Mercury delay duetting with himself during the spectacular December 1975 Hammersmith Odeon performance of the song Now I'm Here. All I do know, it's one of the many bonus tracks including on the definitive, expanded, deluxe edition Queen 40th Anniversary First Five Albums. Still to come, Brian May reveals that Queen almost abdicated the throne after only three albums. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and visit InTheStudio.net for more. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Brian May and Roger Taylor of Queen Part 1. On the North American leg of Queen's tour with Adam Lambert, I spoke to drummer-singer Roger Taylor about Queen Live at the Rainbow 74.
The thing is, you can draw a straight line from what you were doing after the second album and as Sheer Heart Attack
just
was coming out.
Just before the Sheer Heart Attack album,
You can draw a straight line from that to what I just, and what you just performed and I just witnessed last night. That's amazing.
Yeah, I guess it is. I mean, we include in our act now, we're including some of those early songs.
I know.
And the reason is that I had a copy. I hadn't heard this stuff for 40 years. And I had a copy of The Rainbow, Live at the Rainbow. And I had it in my car. I was on the way to rehearsals the first day. And I said, Brian, look, these tracks sound great. You know, why don't we do some of this really ancient stuff? I'd forgotten that we were a really heavy band. We were, you know, before we'd had any hits, sort of pop hits, we were a heavy band, and that really is accentuated on those tracks.
You can hear the progression from when you played The Rainbow in March, which is on disc one, is an entire set, and disc two is November, and I've got written in my notes here, heavier sound in November.
Yeah, yeah.
You're still evolving.
I think we were definitely evolving between Queen 2 and Sheer Heart Attack, which I think is one of my favorite albums. But I had forgotten that we were a heavy act.
What a voice! Freddie Mercury's incredible pipes leading Queen, headlining London's Rainbow Theatre for the first time in late March 1974, opening with Brian May's symphonic Procession into Father to Son. Again, Roger Taylor of Queen with me in the studio.
It begs the question in general, before we get to any specifics, why? How could something that good sit on the shelf for 40 years? Was it entangled legally? Was there some technical?
Might have been something like that, but, you know, and then I think there were some difficulties with the management.
Because
of course, we sort of moved on mentally and forgot about it. But life seems to fall on the flip of a coin, doesn't it, sometimes?
Yes, it does. Of course it does.
You know, imagine if the Who, Live at Leeds was a very sort of casual thing, I think.
It was.
Had that not come out, I think that was a major thing for them. But it was very much a sort of slung together project.
You're absolutely right. I've asked Pete about it at length.
Yeah, for a lot of people, that was a turning point with the Who, you know, and one of my favorite bands of all time.
And mine as well.
Yeah.
Before taking the stage to headline the Rainbow in March 74 for the first time, what reasons did you have for being so bold? What had transpired to date to make you think that you were ready, that Queen was ready?
Well, it's interesting. It was a prestigious place to play in London at the time. It's a beautiful old theatre. And I don't know. I think we did have a certain inbuilt collective arrogance. I think it was the group thing. You know, it was just being a group. Individually, I don't think we were arrogant. But as a group, we thought we could sort of conquer anything. And to have that belief is like a necessary ingredient, I think. I mean, not always the most attractive thing, but I think you have to think that you're good. You know, shrinking violets are unlikely to succeed.
Not in this business.
I think.
Here's guitarist, singer, songwriter Brian May.
You were just lads. You were just...
Well, we were just boys.
Yeah, but you were a good live band.
Yeah, I think we were pretty good looking.
And there were no tricks back then.
No, there weren't any tricks to be had, no. It was all live and dangerous, as it is now with us, you know, and we're pretty proud of that. But we looked back, and I think we were a little nervous once the tapes came out of the box, you know, thinking, what on earth are we going to sound like? But Roger and I were both pretty shocked. We thought, yeah, actually, we knew what we were doing in those days. We were very clear, and we were very well oiled, in a sense. You know, we knew each other already very well. we'd worked hard on getting the coherence of the band. And I think we were lucky. You know, we're lucky that we found each other, because nobody could put together a band like that. It had to happen organically. We had to find each other somehow, naturally. And we shared that vision, and we shared a work ethic already. And, you know, and we had Freddie. boy,
that was your secret weapon, wasn't it?
Boy, oh boy. But also, we had John. You know, people forget, you know, what an extraordinary link in the chain he was. You know, we were very interactive, and the four of us all had a great influence on each other and on the eventual outcome. So it was a magical combination, and, you know, yeah.
How did that come together, that your first time you headlined the Rainbow, that there was people filming it and recording it professionally? That's expensive. It's yeah. bulky back then. It was hard to do back then.
Well, I'm not going to claim credit, but we had an overall kind of ethos that it was always worth investing in ourselves and the future. So everything was a gamble. We were already deeply in debt, but we were always thinking, well, it's worth spending the money now. We don't need to be making money now. We need to be investing in the growth of what we've put together. So there was never any question. And I don't think we made a profit on a tour until the last one, the one wherein we did Wembley, 1986. I don't think we ever made an overall profit because we spent so much on the tour.
Are you serious?
Yeah, that's right. And we were making money off the records. In those days, you could. I don't know if you can these days. Right. But in those days, yeah, we just put everything we could into the tour, investing in great toys and great people. You know, people are worth looking after and paying well, you know. So hopefully we always looked after people, and we always had the state of the art gear and thought it was worth it. And if the balance at the end of the tour was like in the red, that was okay, because we sold records and we had the experience, and we were building for the future.
I'm told that there were some doubting Thomasons, some naysayers that were actually saying in the very powerful English music press,
yeah,
that they thought that you weren't quite going to be quite ready before the show in March at the Rainbow.
Well, probably. I mean, we did use that. The English music press was a very strange animal. It was both powerful and fiercely fashion conscious. It would switch allegiances in a few days, and very vitriolic. And I think that was the way that the young journalists in the English music press, they saw themselves as the creators of a scene.
Kingmakers.
And I think...
Or in your case, queenmakers.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think they sort of used this sort of sarcasm and vitriol to sort of show off as writers, I think, really. And it was more about presenting themselves as witty observers of the zeitgeist than it was actual really meaningful criticism, you know, so I take it all with a pinch of salt.
Of course. Now, just before you did that March show at the Rainbow in 74, you had done a rather high-profile tour in support of Mott.
Yes, yeah.
Do you remember some of the reviews that Queen got as on the same stage with Mott?
Well, I just remember the tours being such fun.
Oh, good.
And such a learning experience for us. Obviously, you know, we tried to give them a run for their money every night, but they were a good live act.
They had a very partisan crowd.
Yeah, absolutely.
Loved them to death.
Yeah, and actually who we went down pretty well with, you know. But it was great. It was a learning experience for us as well. We did learn from them. Ian Hunter, their lead singer, had a great sense of drama and theatrical presentation in a totally rock and roll context, and we loved that, and I think we probably nicked a bit of that, you know, and simple lighting ideas, you know, which not a lot of people were aware of at the time.
How did you find yourself now, early 74, once again, a couple of months before you would have headlined the Rainbow for the first time, how did you find yourself on the telly? How did you get on Top of the Pops?
I gather the story goes, I think David Bowie had to pull out because I think he was sick or something. And so we suddenly got this, get to the BBC, you've got a Top of the Pops slot. And we got to the BBC and we shot it because they were on strike. The cameraman or somebody was on strike at the BBC. So it wasn't in the normal big studio with the kids and everything. It was shot in the weather studio. So there were four cameras and us.
You got that to fall back on.
In a room 20 feet square, you know. And that was our first appearance on national TV. But, you know, Freddie acted it up and we were all dressed to the nines and, you know, in this sort of black and black and more black and shiny black, matte black, everything black. But it had a great effect because I think it came over as being slightly dangerous, you know, fear me, you lords and lady preachers. Fear me, you parents out there. It was more like it, I think. But it was a great start for us. That was the first sort of sniff of a hit.
Queen, live at the Rainbow 74 from March, and a spirited romp originally on their debut called Keep Yourself Alive, a song which would soon become a case of life imitating art for at least one band member, which we'll hear later. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Queen's Roger Taylor and Brian May for the double CD Queen, live at the Rainbow 74.
Hi, this is Roger Taylor of Queen in the studio.
Hello, folks. This is Brian May speaking to Redbeard. And I'm in the studio for Queen live at the Rainbow 74.
Thank you, gentlemen. A real treat. The summer of 1974, after Queen first headlined at the Rainbow Theater, was a pivotal time for the band, according to Queen singing drummer Roger Taylor.
I think you alluded to this a moment ago, but how big a venue, who had played there, about the prestige factor of headlining the Rainbow Theatre?
Yeah, well, it was, in those days, shows weren't, you know, stadium shows didn't really exist.
No.
It's hard to imagine, actually, but so these big, old theatres, it's about 3,000 people, you know, not huge by a lot of standards, but with an enormous, beautiful proscenium arch with a complete Spanish village over the top of it.
And great acoustics.
So they were the top venues, really. There was that one, and there was what was called the Hammersmith Odeon. They were probably the two top venues in London at the time. And the Rainbow had a slightly cooler thing. David Bowie played there. I saw Eric Clapton and people like that.
That's right.
Well, we were halfway between albums at the time. You know, we'd done Queen 2 and we were about to do Cheer. I think we maybe started Cheer Heart Attack. So, yeah, it was a sort of a bit of a hotbed of creative activity at the time. And we were quite excited. We could see results, you know, and we were quite ambitious with the show. And although, you know, these days, it's a small show. But for those days, you know, very few bands were dressing up unless they were going the whole kind of glam look, you know. But we weren't that. We were sort of darker than that. You know.
Good point. What do you attribute the fantastic recorded quality that you got on that night? I mean, it's a hand-in-glove kind of a thing. You have to have a really good band, because there were no tricks back then.
No.
There was no place to hide.
Oh, that's absolutely right, yeah. There were no tricks. Brian, I noticed how well Brian was playing, how crisp. But
your toms sound fabulous.
Yeah, they sound that big, fat sound.
To get noticed in London in 1974, Queen was vying for press attention at a time when the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin were neck and neck for world's greatest rock band. Plus, it was the absolute peak for progressive rock. Bands like Yes and the Moody Blues and Jethro Tull had number one albums, as well as David Bowie and the glam bands. This I reminded to Queen's Brian May.
Then you were elbowing at the bar for a column in the music press back then.
Well, I don't know. You know, the music press was never our friend. You know, we were always sort of fighting, like you say, with the press, who for some reason thought we were insignificant on the whole, you know, with a couple of exceptions. I don't think we regarded it as a competition, but we we had a kind of pioneering spirit. You know, we thought we were great. You know, we were precocious boys. We thought we had something exceptional to offer, and we never questioned it. So internally, we had a great strength, a great belief. But England was very, you know, we were in England. We weren't in the world at that time, really. We hadn't really started in the world. We were just in the UK. And Britain is very fashion conscious. Britain works on waves of fashion, sort of, which seem to be, it still works that way.
Really?
I think. Yeah, I think so. You know, something will be the thing at a particular time, and everybody will jump on a bandwagon, and that will be cool, and nothing else will be cool. So, and to that kind of, in that context, we weren't very cool. We were doing something which was sort of outside whatever the trend was. So we weren't selling thousands and millions of records. But in the live situation, we had a lot of believers and we were building the live thing. But it doesn't happen overnight. You know, there was no internet in those days. There was no, you know, things were so different. There was not even any mobile phones when you think about
it. There was no rock on TV in America.
No, there was no, wheels were square in those days, you know.
That's good.
No, but you know, it was vastly different in those days, and we did it what was really the classic way. We did it by constantly touring, constantly playing, partly because we loved it, we liked that feeling, but partly because that was how to pay your dues and that was how to build yourself as a band. And complementing that was the studio album, which happened every year. You know, we would spend probably 3 months making the album and roughly 9 months touring if you check back.
Wow.
That was life for us, and we loved it. We thought we were lucky, and we were.
Yeah. Spectacular performance and top-notch sound on Now I'm Here, originally on the then-new third album, Sheer Heart Attack, in November 1974, by Queen, live at the Rainbow, 74. Queen guitarist Brian May credits an earlier tour supporting Mott the Hoople as very educational in several ways.
With Mott the Hoople, you know, Mott were great for us. They were a great example for us as to how you live on the road, you know, how to be a rock star. A few easy lessons. They were fabulous, Mott. I mean, I feel sad, actually, when I think of Mott, because they should have been the biggest band in the world at some point. You know, and they blew it by splitting up. You know, that's rule number one. You do not split up. You know, because you have to realize that as a group you're greater than the sum of your parts.
Right.
You know, and it's classic. And they were fantastic on that tour. I remember watching them do All the Way from Memphis in Memphis, and the place erupted. You know, it was just, they were insane. And
that's the night that after the show, Ian went to Graceland and went over the fence.
Yes, that's right.
One of the best stories I ever
heard.
That's
a good story. There's some stories which have never been told, really, about what happened in the Holiday Inn next to the Mississippi down there. It was incredible, you know, and it blew all our minds. And we sort of were baptized into the world of living on the road as rock and roll heroes, I was going to say. We weren't exactly heroes in those days, but it was fantastic because we were pitched right into the middle of it. And on and off stage, it was full on, 1,000,000% full on rock and roll.
By the time Queen would headline two nights at the Rainbow Theater in November 1974, Roger Taylor credits one song as critical to their development. Suddenly, you've got a hit, your first one on both sides of the pond with Killer Queen.
Yeah, and Killer Queen was a real quality record, and we put a lot of effort into making the harmonies sit right, and they're quite intelligent harmonies, and so I think it was a very fine, sophisticated song, and for those reasons I think it was a fairly unstoppable hit. It just, when we did it, we thought, that sounds like a hit record, and we didn't think about making singles then. We were an albums band, so we never really weren't aiming for singles, but just the way that turned out, it just sounded so infectious and
undeniable.
Yeah.
Queen live at the Rainbow 74 in November this time with a medley of Killer Queen, Black Queen, and Bring Back That Leroy Brown. Still to come, a serious health crisis almost turns fatal for young Brian May.
The fact that the Sheer Heart Attack was a hit album, quite a big hit, we didn't see any money. And I think that, you know, it just sort of magically disappeared. into our bank manager's swimming pool, I think. But into our manager's swimming pool and his new Rolls Royce. But so when we recorded A Night at the Opera, we were broke, and so it was such a gamble, and we knew that this is you know, this is it, you know, this better work. And especially with a song like Bohemian Rhapsody, it's such a chance to take.
Truth be told, history came perilously close to being rewritten for Queen that summer 74. Here's guitarist, singer, songwriter Brian May.
Plus, I got very sick, you know, there was all that going on. You know,
what happened?
I somehow got hepatitis when we were doing that first support tour with Mott the Hoople.
Oh, with Mott. And so how do you deal over the spring and summer with a serious illness?
Well, we got to New York, which was one of the pinnacles, and did the Eurus Theatre, thank God. Sort of a Broadway kind of expedition for Mott, which we shared. And, you know, it was good of them to share it with us, really. And then off we went to Boston, and I woke up completely yellow.
Oh, my.
And feeling really, really bad.
Jaundiced.
Yeah, and nobody knows how it happened. I don't know how I got that. Hepatitis.
Oh, it happens just from close quarters. It happens to kids when they go away to college and they live in a dorm room together.
Yeah.
It happens.
Yeah. So they shipped me back home, and that was the end of that tour, which was really sad for everybody. But, you know, everyone dealt with it really well. I didn't get any resentment from the rest of them. And then following that, I was sort of recovering from that, and then we started work on the album, and I was thrown up every, well, few times a day.
Oh, yeah.
And we started thinking, well, this is not the hepatitis. I'm sort of over that. What is this? And I ended up on the floor of this specialist's clinic in a bad way. And he said, I think we better take you in. And in King's College Hospital, they operated on me the next day because I had basically an extreme form of ulceration of the stomach.
Mm.
And it was
you
extreme.
Can die from that.
I would have died without a doubt.
Bleed internally.
Yeah, well, not just that, but also, if you want to know the details, there was so much ulceration, which had been going on since I'd been a child, apparently,
really?
That nothing was getting through my body, basically.
Gosh.
So I was eating food, and it couldn't get out, so it had to come back up. Are you enjoying this explanation?
Bless your heart.
Yeah, so I was no wonder I was in a pitiful state, you know. So they fixed it up. They sort of replumbed my insides. And
I didn't realize that you'd had surgery.
Between these
two dates and done a studio, your best studio album to date in Sheer Heart Attack.
Yeah, well, there's an irony in the Sheer Heart Attack title there, you know, because I was nearly, you know, I owe my life to those people.
Wow.
In King's College. So that was quite serious. And I was in hospital, and we were halfway through the album, so Freddie and Roger and John would pop in and make me laugh, which would almost
hurt.
Kill me, because I had this huge incision down my middle.
Don't make me laugh.
Yeah, don't make me laugh, guys. Oh, thanks. And but they brought me in the tapes of what they were doing, and they were continuing with the record. But I remember Freddie saying, don't worry, darling, you know, we're not going to finish it without you. We need you back. Freddie was great. He was very supportive, always, you know, he's very caring.
Hi, this is Brian May from Queen, and welcome back to In the Studio.
I'm Roger Taylor of Queen, and welcome back to In the Studio.
Thanks again, guys. I'm Redbeard. Their fourth album, 1975's A Night at the Opera, was so successful worldwide and influential on rock music and popular culture to this day that we previously have dedicated an entire show just to it. But what is little known, even to fans of the band, is what Queen songwriter, singer, guitarist Brian May revealed to me in the studio.
We were all desperately scribbling away at the time. You know, we had a very high output, each of us separately, and there was a big struggle to sort of find out which things would go on the album. And it was a time of great release for us because we just almost had to sort of give up hope, because we got into such terrible management problems and we were totally broke. And we just signed a new management deal which was going to relieve us of all our debts. And this was a guy called John Reed, who's Elton's manager. And he said, look, I'll deal with all your troubles, go away and make an album. So we did. And the stuff just flowed out with a great sense of relief. And there was loads and loads of it.
Queen drummer, singer, songwriter Roger Taylor.
I would say it cemented our worldwide success. We'd had limited success to an extent with Sheer Heart Attack, the album before that. But I think A Night at the Opera sort of seriously cemented that in a wider context, you know. It was a very big album in England and sort of everywhere, really. I think, and it consolidated what we'd done in America. We just started, really, with the third album. So it was the sort of clincher, in a way, in the early stage of our career.
Brian May.
For a while, put the guitar slightly towards the back, because I was so concerned with doing this job. I always felt that way anyway. I always thought that a song is primarily about singing, you know, and the guitar is wonderful if it's there, you know, and we all love guitar playing. I love the noise the guitar makes. But unless you have a good song and a good framework, you're wasting your time, you know. So in my mind, you get the song right, you get the singer right, and then you get the guitar part right.
Got my time in right and got my hands up.
Tie Your Mother Down, the bombastic, thrashy rocker, comes from the 1976 follow-up to A Night at the Opera, the similarly Marx Brothers movie-inspired A Day at the Races. Volumes have been written about the production excesses from Queen and producer Roy Thomas Baker, the sexual innuendo from the very name to some of the veiled lyrics, the kitschy humor, and Freddie Mercury's prancing and preening performances. But Brian May reminded me that was only so much window dressing.
I think we always had this thing about the song coming first. You know, if the song would come in, we'd say, well, that doesn't need to be forced into a standard rock and roll mode. We should do what the song demands. So we would bring in all kinds of instruments and play around with them. And sometimes the text just got very mixed up, and it was very, very us, I suppose. Yeah, we felt very free because we had a nice... We had an audience who understood us and didn't want us to make the same kind of sound every time.
Anybody find me somebody to
stand on my feet.
Take a look in the mirror and cry.
Lord, what you doing to me? Yeah. I have spent all my years in believing you, but I just can't get no relief. Lord, somebody, can anybody find me? Every day of my life, I work till I ache my bones. At the end
of the day,
I take home my heart on me. All of my own is higher down. My knees and my eyes fade away till the tears run down from my eyes.
Lord,
somebody,
please. Somebody to love.
Somebody to Love from 1976's Queen album A Day at the Races really spotlights Freddie Mercury not just as a gifted singer with an operatic range and power, but a world-class frontman, according to Brian May.
A lot of the reason that Queen succeeded was that there were other ingredients in there, you see. We were a four-piece and everybody had their area, you know, and the, one of the most important areas was this business of getting across. You know, the bridge between music for music's sake and the art and the listener and the audience. And really that's what Freddie did. You know, Freddie was the consummate purveyor, and I don't think he would be at all insulted by me saying that. You know, he was great at getting things across, and he said, what's the point of making music in a vacuum? I want people to hear my music.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's the way I am. You know, I was lucky to have Freddie all those years who performed that function. He's not there now, and I have no desire to live in the past whatsoever. So I said to myself, if I have a career in the future, I have to take hold of it in my own two hands. That's the only way it's going to happen. And it just happened that life had led me to that conclusion anyway. You know, I mean, we talked about this a while ago, you know, but I'd been through kind of losing a parent, losing the group, losing my marriage, losing my kids, all this sort of stuff, you know, without wishing to go into details. And to get through all that kind of stuff, you have to kind of get hold of yourself and say, right, if I'm going to survive, if I'm not going to jump off the bridge, I'm going to be my own person. I'm going to take hold of my life and put it where I think it should be.
That was Brian May explaining how he and Roger Taylor would reform Queen in the 21st century with Paul Rogers singing, even after the tragic death of Freddie Mercury in 1991 from AIDS. But here on the 40th anniversary of Queen's formation, Brian May still is humbled by the entire experience.
No, you know, I still think it's a dream sometimes. Sometimes I think that you know, there's this theory that it's only me that exists and everything else is a dream. You know, I still get that feeling sometimes because everything is so incredibly, I was going to say lucky, but it's unusual in every respect. You know, we had these incredible dreams, but I think along with the sort of precociousness and the belief and the sort of belligerence of trying to achieve your dream, there's a little piece of you inside which says, no, this is impossible. We could never do this. So I still have that, you know, and I wake up some mornings and think, how did that happen? How did we become this sort of worldwide phenomenon? It's great. It's amazing. And I feel very grateful. And I think I still have a problem putting it in its place. Maybe that's lucky too.
It's so easy, but I can't do it. So risky, but I got a chance. So funny, but there's nothing to laugh about. My money is all you want to talk about. I can see what you want me to be. I'm no fool. It's in the lap of the God. Oh,
And who could forget Queen in all of its grandeur and majesty with 100,000 singing in unison July 1986 in London's huge Wembley Stadium? Just another bonus track now included. I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this.